Are we on?
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Business, Transportation, and Economic Development Committee. First bill we're going to take up is Senate Bill 506. I'll open a public hearing. Richard?
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 506 allows employees in firms with at least 25 employees to take family leave to deal with the death of a family member. It limits the period of leave due to the death of a family member to 2 weeks or 6 weeks with medical verification. It requires that leave due to death of a family member be counted towards the total period of authorized family leave. There's no revenue impact, but I have not yet received a fiscal on this measure.
Thank you. First person to sign up is Jan DuPont. Please.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Senator Beyer, and members of the committee, for giving me this time today. My name is Jan DuPont. I'm a licensed clinical social worker with the Willamette Valley Hospice. I'm currently living in Dallas. I'm supporting SB 506. Briefly, in January 2005, my husband's stepfather died suddenly. He was an important part of both our families, and we were both stunned by his death. Both our employers at that time allowed bereavement leave. Having this leave in place provided the needed time for us as a family to come together, to grieve, to be able to plan for the funeral, and to be able to attend the funeral. It allowed us time to recover before we had to resume our responsibilities at work. This year I have a coworker that experienced a close family death, and because there was some bereavement leave, she was able to have that time. She was able to be with her family member before she died, and she was able to plan for the funeral and be with her family, and it's given her time to recover from her grief. In my work as a bereavement counselor, though, I've worked with families that haven't had bereavement leave. They haven't had time to even plan for a funeral sometimes. Sometimes they barely have time to just attend the funeral, and sometimes they don't even have time for that. They're not allowed that time. And what I found is that not having that time has intensified their grief. They haven't had that time of closure. They haven't had time to come together as a family. So it's really impacted them. As I see grief, the effects are physical, emotional, social, and spiritual, and they can last for a long time anyway for families after someone suffers a loss. And not having that time of closure with family and not being able to attend or be with the family or attend the memorial or funeral, a lot of times that grief experience is prolonged, and it just makes it worse and more intense. So I really feel that bereavement leave, as well as family leave, when there's a series of health problems, those are important benefits that every employer should allow for their employees. So those are my feelings. I'm open to any questions. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Does anyone have questions?
You did a great job. I know you're nervous. You did a great job.
Thank you.
Very much so. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Christy Mahalan.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, Committee Administrator Berger, Senators Girard, Burdick, Vice Chair Atkinson, and Senator Starr. I am Dr. Christine Munholland. My address for the record is 8580 North Charleston Avenue in Portland, Oregon, 97203. I've submitted written testimony as well in support of Senate Bill 506, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today and share my experience and background in support of this measure. I'm the bereavement coordinator for the second largest hospice in the state of Oregon. Can you all hear me okay?
No, we're fine.
Okay. I'm the bereavement coordinator for the second largest hospice in the state of Oregon. I'm also adjunct assistant professor at Portland State University and the University of Portland. And I feel very much as though I'm here today on behalf of my clients. And since they could not be here with me this afternoon, I just wanted to share with you a few examples of the folks that I've provided care to in the last few months. Joanna is 41, the mother of a five-year-old. Her husband died of metastatic pancreatic cancer. She works in the school system, and her husband was a stay-at-home father. Wayne is 60. His wife went into anaphylactic shock in the dental office while he waited for her in the waiting room. She died of cardiac arrest later that day. He works in building security. Rachel and Doug are a married couple in their 40s. Their 19-year-old son died of leukemia after many years of treatment. Rachel works in accounting, and Doug works in law enforcement. And Susie is age 35. Her 54-year-old mother died after complications of surgery. Susie works in child care. Loss of a loved one is commonly recognized as one of the most stressful life events anybody can experience. Grief is debilitating on every level of functioning, emotional, cognitive, behavioral, social, and physical. And the common symptoms that many bereaved people experience, including uncontrolled anxiety and sadness, poor concentration and attention, cloudy thinking, poor memory, greatly impaired sleep, and overall fatigue that are very common also greatly impact those individuals' ability to do their jobs. When you consider that some individuals are working in circumstances where they're caring for others or required to operate machinery, engage in a way that might be considered dangerous, all of those symptoms actually impair them from doing their job safely. Additionally, handling the practical matters that follow a death, such as settling estate affairs, changing billing accounts, attending funerals, arranging child care, elder care, all of those things take time. If a loss is not expected, but occurs suddenly and is unanticipated, that creates additional hardships for coping. Coping is that much more significantly impaired if the death occurs after a violent death, such as homicide or suicide. I'd like to mention as well that in my experience, I don't think if this measure were to be passed that all individuals in the state would take leave. They wouldn't use the bereavement leave. Many can't afford the loss of income. And for many, the structure of their jobs is actually helpful, gives them an opportunity to be distanced from their loss for some period of time. But for those who do need the leave, I believe this will enable them to come back to their jobs more productive and more capable of meeting their professional obligations. Lastly, I'd just like to share that I think it was a very compassionate and well thought out decision in our country to afford people who were caring for a terminally ill loved one 90 days of leave. I think equally it's terribly unfortunate that companies are only allowed by their own discretion to give employees 3 days leave after somebody has died. I'd like to suggest that I think if this measure were to pass, it would be a sensible, proactive, and a humane movement in favor of people who are grieving. I think it would be amazing for Oregon to be a leader in this capacity, and I believe it's the right thing to do. I very much appreciate the opportunity to share my experience with you, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Okay.
Let's see, Nancy Hancock.
Chairperson Beyer and members of the committee, my name is Nancy Hancock. I live in Salem, Oregon. I am here representing myself and Mr. Robin Zimmerman. He couldn't be here today. I am in support of Senate Bill 506. Death, whether it comes after a protracted illness or in the blink of an eye, has the same result: survivors left behind. The initial shock will leave a family unable to function with their daily lives. Even the basic chores of fixing and eating meals will disappear into a fog. I know the effects of this from personal experience. Everyone at some point in their lives will be touched by death and its aftermath. Grief, bereavement, and recovery are largely ignored and unspoken in our society today. We go from day to day thinking we will be immune. It will not happen to me. Or I could handle it. It is a standard that 3 days are given for employee to arrange and attend a memorial, but no time to address the loss and the effect it has on the individual or their family. The disruption may mean finding daycare, arranging therapy, or a complete restructuring of the whole household dynamic. I feel an effective way to help with this is by amending the Oregon Family Leave Act to allow protected time off in the event of a death in the family. When considering this bill, think to yourself, how would I handle or how have I handled this kind of loss? Could I make all the necessary arrangements and put my household back together in 3 days? Now consider how much time would I want my family allowed if I were to die? The truth is that every one of us will face the death of a family member at some point in our lives. I can also tell you how the death occurs will make no difference. You can get a call in the middle of the night to be told there's been an accident. Or you can spend a year at someone's bedside as they suffer through an illness. Either way, you will sit there in disbelief wondering how you came to this point, having believed it would never happen in your life. I have lost 3 friends recently, 2 to melanoma and 1 to murder. These women left behind a total of 6 children. Out of their 3 dads, 1 lost his job due to time taken off to settle their new lives. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Sybil Heeb.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Sybil Heeb with the Oregon Law Center. Sorry.
Sorry about that.
No worries. In support of Senate Bill 506, and you have written testimony, I wanted to offer my comments. The Law Center, as you may know, provides free legal assistance to low-income Oregonians in civil matters. Our clients are lucky if they have jobs. They struggle to keep their jobs. It's incredibly important to them in terms of their ability to meet their basic needs for themselves and their families. They rely greatly on the current protections of Oregon family leave law and on other protections that allow time off to address immediate safety concerns if they're victims of domestic or sexual violence. And those are provisions in the current law that allow them to safely address important concerns related to their families while also maintaining their ability to put food on the table. And so in a case in which a person suffers a death of a family member, the same considerations are to be applied. And a person, especially if a death is sudden, may be thrown into complete chaos and may have really important issues to take care of to make sure that their family is able to proceed, to make sure that funeral arrangements are handled, etc., as you've heard. And we think that the same analysis applies when a death occurs in a family as when there is an illness or the birth of a child or an immediate safety risk. So for these reasons, we're supportive of this bill. We're also very much in support of the general consideration that the legislature and businesses and the communities have brought to the issue of work-life balance. It's an important balance. There are no straight, hard, and fast answers, but where there are compelling circumstances, such as when a family member has died, it's important that we protect a person's ability to address those circumstances while not putting their jobs at risk. So we appreciate your attention to this.
You might know the answer. Is leave required to be compensated?
It's not under this provision.
It's not?
It's not.
Compensated. Okay.
Senator, let me ask her the question.
Huh?
We have a question as to what constitutes a family member. And the fact is, it's not defined in here, so you have a lot of sympathy for it being a husband or a child or maybe your mom and dad, but, your mom's second cousin, who's an aunt, that probably isn't what we're looking for. So do you know if in this bill, I don't see where it's defined. Is it defined in statute anywhere?
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, it's a good question. To my knowledge, and there are probably other experts about the family law, family leave law in this room, so I'll defer to them, but my understanding is that there is a definition of family member in the family leave law. This bill amends a certain provision of it. My understanding would be that it would be a consistent definition. So I can't tell you off the top of my head exactly what that definition is, but I'd be certainly happy to get that information to you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. For the record, my name is J.L. Wilson, representing Associated Oregon Industries. And as you'd expect, I'm representing the other side of the coin here on this issue. We would not support Senate Bill 506 in its current form. We don't have an issue with bereavement leave on its face. The issue is obviously the complex weave of leave laws that are already in place in Oregon, which we're adding to with Senate Bill 506. Oregon's leave laws are liberal. We have one of the most, I would consider, most companies would say we have one of the most burdensome set of laws, and it really relates to two things. The size of employers who Oregon's leave laws apply to. Our laws apply to employers of 25 or more, as opposed to the federal leave law, which applies to employers of 50 or more. We also have this issue of deviation from the Federal Family Leave Act, which Oregon, an employer, has to look at leave rights under two separate lenses. What's allowed under OFLA, the Oregon Family Leave Act, and what's allowed under the Federal Family Leave Act. And you have to weigh both circumstances, and usually, in fact, I've got 16 pages here of regulation that Boley took inventory of where Oregon's law is different from the federal law, and the issue is which lens do you look at when you judge leave occurrences as an Oregon employer. Most of those are going to be favorable toward the employee. Senator Girard, to your comment on who constitutes a family member, there is a defined definition in Oregon's family leave statutes. You're talking about spouses and domestic partners, biological, adoptive, or foster parents or children, grandparents, grandchildren, parents-in-law, and anybody who has established essentially a parental relationship. Those are what that's the consistent definition of family in our family leave law. The issue with 506, and it's important to understand, under Oregon's family leave law today, a man can essentially take 24 weeks off. A woman can take up to 36 weeks off per year, per calendar year, under Oregon's family leave law. How that works is a woman can take 12 weeks for pregnancy, 12 weeks for parental, and 12 weeks for sick child consecutively. A man obviously does not have the pregnancy leave option available to them, but they can take 12 weeks of sick child, 12 weeks of parental. What I'm unclear about 506 is whether we're adding a new time frame to the 36 or 24 weeks that are already available. That is, we have 2 weeks of granted leave per occurrence in Senate Bill 506, which can be stretched to 6 weeks if it requires counseling on the part of the employee. Is this time that's added to the already available 24, 36 weeks, or are we folding this into existing leave? Those are the types of things that would need clarification. Senate Bill 506 also allows for intermittent leave. I will just tell you, representing employers, intermittent leave is the bane of our existence because you don't have to notify an employer. You can just say, I'm taking family leave off because I have a headache, and there's really nothing you can do about it as an employer. So limiting what I would consider abuse of intermittent leave is something that employers would pay attention to. You know, I don't want to be insensitive to this topic. Obviously, employers have bereavement policies already in place. And one other thing I would bring up is Oregon has already seen significant changes in its family law leave laws in the past couple of years. We now add grandparents and grandchildren as the definition of family. We've now added 2 weeks of family leave for deployment of military personnel, going overseas. We've just recently added that family leave cannot run concurrently with a workers' comp injury, which is a very significant change. And we've also mandated that for employers that they cannot preclude their employees from tapping into paid leaves while on family leave. So there have been a myriad of changes to Oregon's family leave law over the past 3 or 4 years, in which I think we're just simply asking for a breather as it relates to Oregon's leave laws and changing them. But I hope I can be of more help on the technical components of Senate Bill 506, but at this point, adding that additional burden to what's already in place, we would take a pretty dim view of that.
Well, it seems like, Mr. Wilson, that you're, when you add them up, you're thinking those as an accumulating leave. While I could see how that might happen, mm-hmm. I would think the reality is that's rarely, if ever, well, I suppose ever, rarely going to happen that you would see that kind of a thing, that you would have all of that at one time.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Byer. And to respond to your question, I see your point perfectly well. But an employer looks at that and says, gee, I have to hold this job open for a potential of 48 weeks, and I've got to bring somebody in to temporarily do that job, and then I have to hold it open for the employee who's taking the leave. You know, one of the things that doesn't get talked about much.
Pretty unrealistic.
It's not perspective. Understood. But look at it from an employer's point of view. I potentially have to keep a job open for almost a year if you stack up the leaves under current statute. One of the things that doesn't get talked about is really how much it costs to comply with Oregon's family leave statutes, because you are in fact hiring additional people, maybe paying overtime to existing employees. I mean, a manufacturing facility today of a couple hundred employees that we work with on the floor are easily spending $500,000 or more administering OFLA or various family leaves in this state. And, you know, that's a pretty significant number.
Other questions?
Thank you very much.
That's all the people I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Does there happen to be anybody here from Boley who administers this? Conspicuous by their absence. So I think we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 506, and we will. I got both glasses on here, so I can see what the next number is. We will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 173. Rich.
Senate Bill 173 limits amounts of recoverable by medicals. Limits amounts recoverable by medical service provider or health insurance provider for medical services provided in workers' compensation claim resolved by settlement. There's no revenue impact and no expenditure impact. We also have a -1 amendment, which I handed out, and that has no revenue impact and no expenditure impact.
Thank you. Any questions of staff? Seeing none. Chris Frost?
Good afternoon, Chair Byer and Vice Chair Atkinson and the members of the committee. I'm Chris Frost, representing OTLA, and I'd like to explain this bill. First of all, Senate Bill 173 with the -1 amendment was unanimously passed out of Management Labor Advisory Committee with a due pass recommendation on February 25th. OTLA worked with OMA, DCBS, SAFE, and the self-insured stakeholders to address any concerns throughout the MLAC process. This bill pertains only to those injured workers who settled their workers' compensation claims in disputed claim settlements, who choose to pay the medical providers the full medical fee service amount. That's the amount that the provider would have been entitled to had the claim been accepted if they out of the proceeds of the DCS. So currently, when an injured worker settles a disputed claim. The medical providers who charge more than the medical service fee schedule can seek from the injured worker the difference between what they charge and what they would have been paid had the claim been accepted. The injured worker must ultimately pay out of pocket for medical services they thought had already been settled. Under Senate Bill 173-1, if an injured worker chooses to pay 100% of that medical fee service scheduled amount to the provider out of the settlement, the bill would be considered paid in full. The medical provider would no longer be able to collect any remaining balances from the injured worker. Do you have any questions?
Does anybody have any questions? I guess not. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Is it safe? Yes. Go ahead.
Just for the record, we got a letter from Lou Savage, the committee administrator for MLAC, describing their support of the bill. And I can grab copies to hand out for the record.
Okay, if there's nobody else, Chris, absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm Chris Davey with Safe Corporation. Seeing as you invited me, I will just come forward and say that we worked with the proponents of this bill, and the amendments that you have before you are things that we worked out, and we're supportive of it as it stands.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions of Chris? All right, so we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 173, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 173. And there's a long-standing tradition of if MLAC supports it completely, this legislature usually does as well. So given that, the chair would move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 173. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Dash ones are adopted. The chair moves Senate Bill 173 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Senate Bill 173 is moved to the floor with a unanimous vote and due pass recommendation. And is there a volunteer who wants to carry that?
I've been doing the workload in my caucus, so
I'll carry it. Chair will carry the bill. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 172. Richard?
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 172 increases the period from 7 days to 60 days during which injured worker enrolled in managed care organization may receive care not authorized by the managed care organization from an attending physician or nurse practitioner before the insurer or self-insured employer must suspend compensation paid to the worker.
Thank you.
We have no revenue and no expenditure impact.
All righty, so Vern Sabo.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Vern Sabo representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. As described, what this bill would do would expand what is known as the continuity of care provision within the MCO, administrative rule, or statutory language, excuse me. And unfortunately, I have to report that the Management Labor Advisory Committee did not support this incredibly wonderful idea. But what I would like to do is explain the rationale for it is currently the managed care organization panels, in our opinion, are significantly closed, and we've been talking about this issue for a number of years. Now, I don't know what the numbers are relative to the other health care providers, but for chiropractic physicians, for instance, in the Central Oregon area of Bend, Redmond, Primeville, Sisters, there are roughly in excess of 70 chiropractic physicians, but there are only three allowed on panel in that area, and that almost guarantees that the injured worker is not going to be able to see the chiropractic physician of their choice. And it's a lot of this is about access, because there's very few medical physicians that will take on workers' comp claims, and that plays into it. my colleagues consistently attempt to get on panel, and once on panel, they must follow the treatment guidelines of the MCO. And cannot violate those or they'll be kicked off panel. They simply are not allowed on panel. In the Portland metropolitan area, I have between 600 and 700 chiropractic physicians, and there are two main MCOs, and there's 55 on one panel and 56 on the other, and it's a lot of the same colleagues on those panels, and that almost guarantees they're not going to be, the worker's not going to be able to stay with the provider of their choice. And many of the time is the injured worker is seeing that chiropractic colleague because there's a history there, either with the family members, and there's a trust, there's a history of treatment in the past, and they know and trust that provider. And the world's literature is replete with articles that support the notion that the outcomes are superior when a patient or injured worker can self-select the provider of their choice. And so what this would do would simply expand the continuity of care provision. Currently, if they're seeing a current chiropractic physician that they know and trust, and they are enrolled into the MCO, they have 7 days from the date of the letter of the MCO, not the date that the injured worker receives the letter, but the date the letter was written, to find a panel provider. Many times they have to travel to find that provider. What this would do is expand the continuity of care provision to 60 days, and we can pretty much fix the great majority of those individuals with musculoskeletal injuries within that 60-day period. Those who are not, by the sheer nature of the fact that 60 days, they are a complicated case and be rolled into the MCO or more clinicalized or review the case, and rightly so. So again, this would again hope the rationale of it was to allow the injured worker to stay with the provider that they've known and trusted for years. That completes my testimony, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll be willing to answer any questions you might have.
Can you enlighten us at all about the MLAC? I mean, it's interesting that they did not support it; they just took no action. Is that the standard, or?
Yeah, it's pretty much standard.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Davies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Again, I'm Chris Davey with Safe Corporation. Perhaps I'll just start with a comment about the MLAC meeting that I attended when this, I think for the second time, this bill was considered. And the chair of the committee invited the committee members, I think his words were, what's the pleasure of the committee, inviting a motion, either in support or in opposition, I suppose, and no motion was made, and so I would characterize that as the bill failing for the lack of a motion to support.
Deafening silence.
Let me speak briefly to the merits of the bill, because I also spoke to this at MLAC as well. Managed care was first instituted in Oregon in 1990 in the reforms that passed then, and it really has been very successful as being one of the key elements in helping to control workers' compensation costs. At SAFE, we enroll about 5,000 claims a year into managed care, and that simply means that the injured worker has to seek treatment from a member of the panel, and the panels have to be made up with a variety of different medical specialties, and there are hundreds, if not thousands, of physicians across the state that are on one or more of these panels. So a worker has a free choice of physician within the panel. What this bill does is to delay the enrollment of an injured worker into one of those panels for 60 days. And obviously the greatest advantages of this, advantages to the worker in terms of the quality of care, to the employer in terms of controlling costs, the greatest advantage comes when you are able to intervene early and enroll the worker early in the claim. And so for that reason, we did not support this bill. Dr. Sabo's issue is one of the lack of chiropractors on the panel, but what this bill would be to simply deprive everyone from the use of managed care for a period of 60 days, regardless of who the choice of medical specialty was for that injured worker. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Senator Girard?
Thank you, Chair Beyer. The $64,000 question is, would this, in your opinion, increase the rate for workers' comp in the long run?
Mr. Chair and Senator Girard, I think that delaying the enrollment of an injured worker in managed care is going to add to medical costs, and the cost of medical treatment is obviously a large component. About 60% of our claim costs are for medical care, so if that's true, it certainly would increase premiums over the long haul, yes.
Further questions?
No.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all I have signed up. Is there anybody else who would like to comment on Senate Bill 172?
Let me put this in just a second.
Okay. For the record, we did have the MLAC comments, and Richard, it says?
It says, heard bill, no motion was made to support the bill.
Okay. With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 172, and I think we'll take that one under advisement, so we'll give the committee a chance to think about it. I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 171. Richard.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 171 directs the Department of Consumer and Business Services to conduct a study on feasibility of establishing community-based centers of occupational health and education. It requires the Department of Consumer and Business Services to report the results of the study to an interim committee of the Legislative Assembly. It declares an emergency. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. And again, just for the record, MLAC heard this, but they made no motion to support the bill.
Dr. Sabo.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Vern Sable representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. What Senate Bill 171 does is call for a study feasibility study of implementing what is known as the Washington State Center for Occupational and Education. It's a different system of using for workers' compensation. The core foundation of it is basically communication between all the stakeholders, some web-based communication, in that the providers are speaking directly with the employers and the insurers, the injured workers are speaking with the same individuals, and they're all speaking, communicating with each other. There are continuing educational programs for the providers and all stakeholders, so everyone's on the same page relative to one of the most ultimate goals is to provide the best care to injured workers and to, at all costs, prevent disabling claims or time loss. The outcomes have been extremely good. The injured worker satisfaction, stakeholder satisfaction has been very, very good. Medical costs have been reduced and time loss reduced. And preserving an injured worker's right to choose their health care provider, and all without managed care. So this would be a different form, a different system of workers' comp, and this is just asking for a study to see if, in fact, we could implement that study here in Oregon and get similar outcomes, and if so, look at taking next steps. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that completes my testimony. I'd be willing to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, sir. And John Schultz.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We do expect there would be a fiscal impact to this bill. It requires the Department of Consumer and Business Services to evaluate the Washington model of the community-based centers for occupational health used in Washington State. And in addition to general evaluation and specific to look at support services, for to and for training opportunities for health care providers, coordinating services available to workers, developing information technology to track patients and provide health care providers with feedback, and also to review payment incentives that would encourage best practices, as well as identification of any statutory provisions to prevent establishment of these sorts of centers in Oregon. We think that these questions are not small, and that would require us to develop a proposed study. That would be no small effort. We do think this idea has merit, but as we've discussed with some of you directly, the department has undergone significant budget reductions due to the economic downturn. We do not have existing resources to accomplish this study or these tasks without foregoing some of our other statutory responsibilities. The department would need additional resources to produce the quality work that we think you would expect as policymakers to be able to make a decision in 2013 on this subject, and a couple of examples may help here. We would, per the bill, we would have to determine how Oregon, as a multi-payer system, may differ in comparison to Washington, which is a single-payer system. And what I mean by that is Washington is a monopoly workers' compensation system. There aren't private workers' compensation insurance carriers there. There is a state program. In Oregon, for example, we have hundreds of insurers as well as third-party administrators. We don't think we have all the answers nor all the expertise on how to identify the correct compatible technology that would work for all those payers in the Oregon system, and that would take time, resources, and expertise, a lot of discussion with those insurers as well as their contracted providers to accomplish just that one study item, for example. The Management Labor Advisory Committee has heard this bill. They are generally supportive of reviewing some other models. They did express concern about the cost of taking on a new study at this time, and they have not voted to recommend this bill to you at this time. Now, they are meeting on Friday this week. They are meeting with the Center for Research on Occupational and Environmental Toxicology, or CROET for short, which is located at the Oregon Health and Science University. CROET does have expertise in workplace safety and health issues. MLAC intends to ask whether they have resources to assist with an evaluation of this sort of model at that meeting. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can.
Questions? Seeing none. I suspect, Doctor, that you wanted to add something.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, just briefly, there was an action by the Management Labor Advisory Committee on the management side. Kathy
Noshimoto
indicated with the committee suggesting, well, why don't we look at CROET spending some of their money. They retain approximately $6 million a year from the Worker Benefits Fund and the Premium Assessment Fund, and look into the feasibility of having them, using their existing funds, perform the study. And as Mr. Schultz indicated, they will be presenting this Friday, and I'll be in attendance. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
It sounds like we might be prudent to wait and see what they say. Thank you, gentlemen.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing that. That's all I had on this one. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify?
I have a question for the chair or the administrator. This would have to go to Ways and Means, would it not?
It would have to go to Ways and Means.
And there is a fiscal. I said there wasn't. There is, and it was handed out.
But it sounds like not guessing what they're going to do on Friday, but if CROET was going to be involved, it might change the fiscal.
Okay.
So, is there anybody else? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 171, and we will open on 178.
There's no fiscal.
Senate Bill 178 removes requirement for the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to compare state and federal prevailing wage rates and make results of comparison available. It requires public agencies to remove
to require that in contracts for public works, the contractor and subcontractor pay higher of applicable state or federal prevailing wage rates. It declares an emergency. There's no revenue impact, but we have not yet received a fiscal on this matter.
Thank you. Call forward Kate Newell. Hello, Kate.
Okay. Thank you, Vice Chair Atkinson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, and I'm here today with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I thank you for the opportunity to be here to testify in support of Senate Bill 178. As you all know, Oregon's prevailing wage law requires that workers on public construction projects be paid wages and benefits found to be prevailing for similar work in or near the same locality. Senate Bill 178 that's before you today is actually pretty simple. It deletes the requirement that BOLI produce what we call the double rate book. So what is our double rate book? Since 2005, state law has required that contract specifications for projects that are covered by both state and federal prevailing wage laws, that the higher of the two rates be paid on that particular project. It is also required since 2005 and that statute was passed that BOLI publish a semi-annual book of state and federal rate comparisons. However, this book is a pretty complicated, cumbersome, and even confusing publication because the U.S. Department of Labor puts out rates as frequently as 20 times per year. So pretty much the moment that this book is produced and it's out of date and confusing. And so when we produce the book, and I apologize, I'm remiss in not bringing a copy of it. It's 477 pages long. We also put it out with all sorts of disclaimers over it to say, please check with the U.S. Department of Labor's website to ensure that the rates haven't changed for the particular trade or region that you're looking at. Additionally, because it is such a out-of-date book, we don't print very many of them because we find that people don't actually use them. So we're printing them right now at a cost of about $11 per publication, and it takes over 200 hours of our staff time to produce it. In developing this concept, we work really closely with ODOT, which issues the vast majority of double-covered projects, to ensure that the affected contractors could locate the appropriate rates electronically. And as always, our prevailing wage technical assistance unit is available to answer questions that contractors or contracting agencies may have in determining which are the highest of the state and federal rate. And if they're having trouble locating the federal rates on the U.S. Department of Labor's website, we are more than happy to help direct them and target them or even point it out to them on the website. So in developing Senate Bill 178, we worked with all of our stakeholders to ensure their support, which was, and I think you'll hear some testimony after me, which was overwhelmingly supportive. I think everybody agreed that it is a complicated, confusing, and misleading book. We had our prevailing wage advisory committee review the concept, and they all supported it. I also know, even though they weren't able to be here today, that AGC and the building trades are also supportive of Senate Bill 178. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Kate? Thank you very much for coming. Mr. Sean Miller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors. We are supportive of Senate Bill 178, and I also serve as the co-chair of the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee that reviewed the bill. And I just want to comment that we do agree that producing a book that is roughly the size of the telephone book, that the minute it's published, it's out of date, is kind of a waste of money and resources. And so, plus the wages that are in that book give a contractor a false sense of security if they're looking at that wage and use that wage, and unfortunately it's the wrong wage because it's been updated. They cannot use that as a defense because they use the wrong wage. And so, therefore, we think it's a good bill. We would ask that the committee support the bill and move it on to the floor. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions for Mr. Sean Miller? You're excused. That is the last time I'm going to be that nice. Mr. Brian Craig. That's good. I know you're sleepy.
Chair Atkinson, members of the committee. I am Brian Krieg, and I'm here today representing the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors, and IBEW 48. I would like to echo everything that Mr. Miller just said. This is a good bill. It will help avoid potentially making an error. This is a good thing for our contractors. Contracting is complex enough. This will help make sure that we are doing the right thing. And it's environmentally friendly going paperless, so it's a great bill. Please pass it.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you. Brian, the bill looks all right, and this is a little bit off key, but several people in my district have had trouble trying to figure out if to pay travel time or not, and the statutes seem to have been kind of interpreted in a loose sense. The only concern I have for this bill is through administrative rule, the state can change things to the advantage, to one extreme where the federal law is not. Do you have any concerns about that?
Our contractors didn't raise any concerns with that. And if there's confusion about the rates, once again, it does go back that the BOLI staff is there to help make sure that, that it is, they are selecting the correct one.
Well, I'd be real honest. BOLI's not my favorite agency in this building, by any stretch of the imagination. And sometimes they go to extremes, and they do it by administrative rule. And that's the problem. That's what bothers me in this bill. Now, the rates, that might be something that's done more by statute, but travel time, for example, is a big thing in my district because they're trying to say that you have to pay prevailing wage if you pick up a worker and take him over 30 miles to a work site. And that was done by administrative rule. So that really bothers me. And so that's the kind of issue that I think we might have a difference of an opinion from the state to the federal rule.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Brian.
Sure.
Anyone else like to testify on Senate Bill 178? Seeing none, close the hearing. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 178.
Did you break the handle?
No, it's like fire hits that thing hard.
I know, it shatters my eardrum.
Open a work session on Senate Bill 178. Do I have a motion?
Move the bills to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
We don't have a fiscal one.
Excuse me?
We
have not received a fiscal?
We have not received a fiscal or anything from fiscal. So
that's never slowed us down before. All right. Well,
withdraw the motion.
Withdraw the motion and we close the work session.
He's hard of hearing.
There's nothing left more in this debate.
I thought it shot him.
I'm filing a workers' comp claim, Mr. Chair.
Well, we already fixed that. A couple of bills. And we closed the committee for today. Thank you very much.